Welcome to Halal Money Matters, sponsored by Certain Capital. You know, sometimes you get these calls, these texts asking you for, you know, somebody's in trouble, they're looking for help, and they're really playing on your emotions. And other times, when you're trying to open up a bank account or do some simple transaction with a bank or financial institution, you get caught in paperwork or sign this or sign that. Today, we have a very special guest, David Skade, who is going to be talking to us about scams and affinity marketing and how we get caught up in these type of things and what banks do or financial institutions in general do to try and protect us from these things. He has a tremendous amount of experience being an internal auditor for many European banks, and I'm really excited to have him on the show today. Let's get started. Welcome, David.
Hi, thank you.
I appreciate you taking the evening time. I know you're in the UK.
So. That's okay.
So, you know, I wanted to have a podcast in regards to, thinking about it from a perspective of that we've had so many, you hear stories of online scams and people being ripped off with their money and those type of things. So I thought it would be a good idea for us to be able to do a little bit more deeper dive into, you know, what actually happens, not only on the back end for the financial institutions, but also like how do people... How do people get suckered into it, I guess I should say, for lack of a better word. And so there's kind of three areas that I really wanted to focus on. One of them was going to be just the AML side of it. The second one was going to be just the scam. And the other one, which is actually part of the scamming that people do, it's called affinity marketing, which is basically you in your own either ethnic group or religious group or those type of things actually are able to, because of your maybe standing in the community or those things, it's easier for you to scam other people than not. So those are the three areas that I was thinking about talking about.
Okay,
great. So let's start with the AML, which is the anti-money laundering. And I know you have a pretty deep background in it, so I appreciate you taking the time to come on. And I wanted to start off and really talk about this from a perspective of, you know, a lot of people talk about when they open up a bank account or an investment account, it's really cumbersome, right? You need your passport, you need these type of things. And so kind of help us explain why those checks and balances are put into place and what actually happens on the back end.
So people always say it's complicated. It's actually quite easy. From a banking perspective, because it's a legislative requirement. So banks don't make this up. And what you have to do is identify and verify who you are when you go to the bank. So I can tell you I'm David Skade, but you haven't confirmed that. So you need to confirm who I am. So that's why the bank will ask for your passport or a government-issued document that confirms who you are. So a passport is the easiest one to use, or a national identity card, because it's backed by the government. You've had to go through a number of loops to do that. And the other thing you have to have is residential address. There's actually three criteria. The bank has to confirm your name, your date of birth, and your residential address. So in the UK, that's what a bank has to do. Now, the easiest way to do that is a passport, which has your name and your date of birth. It doesn't have your residential address on. So then the requirement is to confirm residential address. And there are a number of documents that are suggested. And a lot of banks in the UK will say, we need a utility bill. The requirement is not a utility bill. The requirement is to confirm residential address. You can do that a lot electronically now by banks. You can do it by scrolling through the electoral register where somebody's registered. And a lot of bank accounts can be done online nowadays because they will use electronic checking against a number of firms and make sure you hit a mark. So the actual requirements from an AML perspective are not that great, really. It's two documents to confirm your identity and to verify it and confirm those three elements: name, date of birth, a residential address. From an AML perspective, that's nice and simple to confirm who you are. But then banks add risk ratings and things like that. So if you're just John Doe off the street, you want to open a retail bank account, it should be quite straightforward. Banks will tend to do searches on you against public domain information. So if you've got a criminal record, particularly in money laundering or fraud, then you become heightened risk. But they start to ask more questions. So for a standard retail bank, if your name pops up on a list and you've got a criminal record, expect to be asked greater questions. Other questions that the banks will ask were, where did the money come from to put into this bank account, and how do you want to use it? So those are the commercial questions as well. But the bank's very interested, where did this money come from? So the source of funds or the source of wealth which are coming into this account. Source of funds is the deposit into the account, and then the source of wealth is how did Mr. Customer accumulate his wealth? And that becomes very important for, say, a wealth management account, investment accounts, etc., where there's a large amount coming into the account. People, definition of large can vary.
Sure. So on the back end of it, I mean, I know that, for example, in the recent environment that we have, probably over the past 20 years, a lot of things have become online, obviously. And you come up with a name like Muhammad Ali, as an example, right? So Muhammad Ali, there's like probably, you know, hundreds of millions of Muhammad Ali's out there. And that's where you verify with your passport or other things like that. But sometimes they do end up failing you because there's a Muhammad Ali living in somewhere else and he has a criminal background and those type of things. So I'm assuming these databases are not perfect.
They're not perfect, but that's why you collect the additional information. So you want place of birth, country of residence. So you start to build the profile. So as you get the data, as you say, using a name like Muhammad Ali, you'll get thousands of false positives. You get all of these people, but then you can strip it down. You know, anybody that's not born in that year, because you've confirmed the year on the passport, anybody that wasn't born in the area that this man says he was born. So you stream it down by adding different data points in until you're quite confident that you've got the Muhammad Ali. Now, most people have more than one name, particularly in the Muslim faith. People will have more than one name, won't they? They won't just have Muhammad Ali. I'm just David Skade, but I could have somebody, David John Skade. We could have, you know, Muhammad Abdullah Ali. So you start to narrow it down by other data points that you would do there. And usually you can get pretty close. But at this point, there's no harm in the bank asking the customer, we found some information about such and such a body. Can you confirm this was you? Or if it is that person, you can always ask them the question. It's not a secret. It's in the public domain.
Yeah.
If they have a criminal record, but it's been spent, then the bank can make a risk decision on whether they wish to provide banking facilities to that customer, or whether the criminal activity or some other news is such that they don't want to manage that person.
So great. And then the second part of that was you mentioned, where does the money come from? And that's an interesting one, because obviously, you know, older generation of people, they never were asked that question. So they're always on edge whenever you ask them, where did the money come from? I'm being one of them, even though I'm very, very young. But kind of the idea here is that it just seems to me like, you know, when you have, like, if you look at all the different money laundering, you know, criminal charges that have been placed against banks, right? It seems like when you're putting moving over $75 million, they don't ask any questions. But if you're moving over $7,500, they'll ask you all a bunch of questions. So it just kind of feels weird that there's the smaller people who are trying to just send money back home, or you know, like happens in the US, or you're on the board of Muslim Aid. So when we're trying to send charitable contributions somewhere else, it's those are the types of things that are stopped.
And I find that an interesting perspective, because people say, oh, it's a new requirement. It's not a new requirement as far as I'm concerned. I've been in banking 40 plus years. And when I was opening accounts for people 35, 40 years ago, I would ask them those sort of questions. Maybe it was just me, but you should understand your customer's needs, because most banks work on we have a customer, we sell them products. If you don't understand the customer's needs and what they have and what they want to use the bank for, how can you possibly sell them products? So asking those questions, what do you do? And you don't have to ask directly, where does your money come from? What do you do as a job? What kind of salary can we expect to see in the account? Do you have any other assets that we should take into consideration here? Because the more you know about the customer, the more you can offer them the products that you have available. For example, do you have a property? Is it mortgaged? Are you looking to move? What is your current term of your mortgage? Maybe we can look at that when it comes to expiry. But what you've done, you've gathered information on assets. Most people's primary asset is their house, it's their home, or a pension pot or savings. But you can start to work out from, if Mr. Customer is on a salary of 100,000, but he's got 5 million in savings, how does that compute? So you have to do a little bit of maths. You know, even if you've got 100,000 a year, say you spend 50,000 on living, you're not going to accumulate that amount of savings. Mm. So you ask the question, where does that come from? How is it managed? For me, that is what a banker should be asking. It's a relationship. So, and I think a lot of people hide behind the money laundering requirements, where for me, they should be doing this as a banker offering a service to a customer. A bank should be helping a customer manage the financial assets that they have. That's a principle that I've always applied. So, and I've worked in retail, corporate, wealth, investment banking, and I've always come up against that challenge with, they determine themselves as relationship managers. And I always say, your job title tells you what you should be doing. Yeah. Doing a relationship with the customer, and that means understanding what financial assets or information he has available, because you as the banker should be looking to manage that.
That's true. And also, I mean, it's just a simple rule of know your customer.
Exactly. So, and people hide about it because it's now become, let's call them buzzwords in the world of AML and the financial crime teams. They'll use these phrases, and they've become common phrases now in banking terminology. But in all my years, unless you know your customer, why have you got a bank account for him? Hmm.
And Tony, you've been in the industry for quite a while now. And you know, I mean, being a Muslim living in the US, or even if you're in the UK, it always feels like we have a little bit more stringent requirements that are there. Would you kind of confirm that, or that's something that's really not? I mean, we don't know what other people are doing either, right? We only get affected when we're the ones who are getting the extra scrutiny and that type of thing. You have a much more bigger picture on the whole working for different banks.
So a good example was I when I came out of the retail corporate world, I first started working in a Middle Eastern wealth management firm. And the requirements as we know them in the UK now were just coming in. It was N2 in the year 2000, and the FSA was around or just forming, the pre-runner to the FCA as it is now. However, one of the requirements was you need to get a residential address. But in Kuwait, as the country was, people don't have utility bills. They live on the third house on the corner down from the petrol station. And they have a PO box to receive their post. So I said, well, the requirement isn't to get that utility bill. The requirement is to confirm residential address. You have to understand, not every country operates the same way as the UK, where you've got or the US, I'm assuming for you, you have a utility and you have a bill. It operates in a different way. People have a national identity card and a passport. And there'll be some information on that national identity card that ties them to a PO box number or something like that. So if you get those two pieces of information, you've confirmed their residential address. But just because it's not in the format that you're used to doesn't mean that it's not true. So that flexibility, I think, is a key element for somebody in the roles that I've had, is understanding the environment that you're operating in as well. Other examples would be people in old folks' homes, care homes. They won't have utility bills because everything is taken care for in the home. And people say, we can't get utility bill, we'll have to close the account. I said, no. Write to the manager of the care home, we'll identify who he is, and he'll get him to confirm that Mrs. Old Lady or Mr. Old Man is resident in that care home. They may not have a passport anymore because they don't travel. They won't have any utility bills, but they should not be disallowed from the banking circles. But if you take that to the Muslim one as well, I think when they do searches against names, bringing those data points together is sometimes a challenge for some of the banks.
Mm.
Not in the format that they're used to, but this has been around a long time now, and banks are getting better, I think, at stripping the data down, but there's more and more data available. You're going to get false positives at any time. And always banks work on a risk versus profit.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make profit. Otherwise, why are we in business? If it's taking too long to process, are we happy with that from a risk perspective and the cost of doing business? Some banks will say, we only want low-risk customers. Other banks will say, we only want this type of customer. But they're allowed to do that. Wealth and investment firms, you'll only say, we only want people with minimum of 10 million of assets or the ability to grow to 10 million in a short term. So that's where you would be looking at those source of funds and source of wealth. Is there potential as well?
So I want to come back to this whole idea that we've been talking about, which is really about knowing your customer. And it's a good segue for us to be able to move into, I mean, I guess, you know, recently, I would say in the past, let's say 4 or 5 years, but it's been a growing trend, but it's really picked up, has really been idea of opening or money laundering, opening up fake bank accounts. It's a lot of times it's these bots that are doing it and those type of things. Segueing that into now talking about just basically scams, right? Where, you know, somebody calls you up and says, oh, I need, you know, we need this much money and those type of things. And I can tell you, David, I've had one scam in my life and it was for a small amount of money, but I still remember it as, right? Yeah. And it's one of those things that hurts a lot. And I was lucky enough there was a small amount of money, but there's other people who lose their life savings because of it. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about that, how it happens, how people, you know, kind of, you know, get suckered into it, those type of things.
Well, let's focus on that one with you. And we don't need the full details here, Monem, but what do you think was the hook that made you, whether you went down the investment route or whether you sent some money off to it? But let's talk it through. What was the initial engagement? How were you approached?
Yeah, it was on a phone call actually. And it happened to be, it was very interesting. I don't know if they knew this in advance or not, but they probably did. This was back in the early 2000s. Let's say that first. So I had just come back from a conference being held by a bank, a major bank. And the person basically knew that I was there, and he said, "Hey, I'm from this bank, and I'm coming to Bellingham to see you. And basically, I just, you know, I my wallet got stolen, and I don't have any money. Can you help me, you know, send over some money so I'll be able to do that?" Now, this gets into the affinity marketing part, because he was, you know, he was Muslim, or he proposed to be Muslim. You know, he said, "Salaam alaikum." He, you know, basically, as he was talking to me, he was talking about how we should be helping our brothers out, and if they're in trouble, we should be doing that. He was using verses from the Quran saying, so he was doing all the right things.
Playing on sentiment, that these people are skilled.
Yeah.
And what the world we live in today is so small.
Yeah.
So social media, people will go to events, they'll post it on LinkedIn, they'll post it on Facebook, they'll post it on Instagram, they'll post it wherever. Hey, guys, I'm in this such and such a place. The bots are searching for that. The bots will find all that. Bots now, but previously it would have just been scammers.
Individuals, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they will be trained. They will have a script that they use, and they will play. They will know that you're Muslim. They will know the words to use. They will know to play on that sentiment and emotion. Emotion is a key thing here. That's why a lot of old people are targeted, because they're vulnerable. So emotion and vulnerability. And then, so the hook for you was helping a brother.
Yeah.
Helping a brother who's in need. Yeah?
Yep.
And we can all fall for that one. The other one is greed. People will pick up on greed as well. People often say to me, why did somebody fall for that? I said, because they were greedy. They've made money previously. They want to make more money. And they will put money into it. I've advised friends, say, do not send £40,000 to such and such a place. A few weeks later, oh, I think I've lost my money, but I might be able to get it back. Say, just wave bye-bye-bye to it. Not-
yeah. So I think here we're talking about two different areas, right? So you're absolutely right. One is on vulnerability and the other one is on greed. And I think you can probably bucket those in two separate areas. So let's just kind of focus on this since we're talking about greed just now. I think the classic greedy financial scheme is a Ponzi scheme. So let's start just by, you know, everybody talks about Ponzi scheme, but let's try to break it down. How would you define what a Ponzi scheme is?
So it's a Ponzi scheme where they promise you riches if you join in. Make a deposit, join in, everybody's doing it. You don't want to be left out because then you'll be losing some money.
Okay.
You put 100,000 in, you'll get some more people in, you know, that you get them to put 100,000 in, you'll get a percentage of it. The money disappears before it's even gone. I've got a good example here. There's a big example, and it's in the public domain. It's one called Payvision BV, where ING Bank is the sole beneficial owner of this firm. There's a number of players in this, and it's a payment services payment institution, and it's a boiler room scam.
Okay.
So like a Ponzi scheme. So, and there's a number of firms. They ripped off thousands of unsuspecting European customers, boiler rooms, investment scams through firms like Xtrader FX, Option Stars Global. They're fraud, money laundering, and these people were all sentenced to lots of jail. So what happened? Payvision held a license as a payment institution for the Dutch Central Bank. And they were founded by this guy called Rudolf Bucker and his partners. They were providing payment services for online shops, and it acts as an acquiring partner for operating companies, merchants of the various websites. And the flows go through specific vehicles, stitching trusted third parties and other such things.
So they're asking for, are they trying to raise equity capital? Is that what they're doing? So let's supposing I gave them $10,000, right? So
yeah, you phone $10,000, they've said, you've got to get in soon. Option 888 is a great firm. We're going in for FX Trader X. You've got to go in, 10,000. We do FX options or things of that nature. Mm-hmm. You, for every profit, you will get a return, but you've just got to go and get some other people. But if you're following all these people, getting everybody to invest £10,000 or €10,000, $10,000, whatever it is. And all of these funds were going through this firm, Payvision. And they were all through shell companies.
Yep.
Mostly were British with nominee directors and nominee shareholders. So the infrastructure behind this was very, you know, nobody knew who was behind it all. And so when you do KYC from a bank's perspective, nominee directors and nominee shareholders should be a red flag. For the people that are being scammed, if you get, like you got, my name, a cold call, somebody trying to offer you something or wanting something from you, and it sounds really, really good, they may not be successful with every phone call. They only need to be successful being one a day. Yeah? But all they're doing is on the phone. 15 minutes, phone call, then the next one.
So now I've sent the money in, right? And this, we can leave it as a general for a Ponzi scheme. So basically what's happening is that they're taking the initial money, they're guaranteeing, you know, huge amounts of money, right? So I take it from you, if I'm the bad guy, I take it from you, and the next person that I take it from, I give you the return of whatever that is. So you're really not investing anything. You're basically robbing Peter to pay Paul.
But they're not giving you 10,000 back. They're giving you a small percentage as a tease. So when it starts off, those little teasers, maybe 5%, you know, for everyone, you might get 5% back. So, and you think, oh, this is genuine. I'm getting a return already. You get a quick return. And then it'll suddenly escalate. It just takes, it's like playing Jenga, one person pull a piece out and it all falls down.
I remember there's a in the Muslim community in Chicago, there was a firm called Sunrise Equity, and this is public information as well. And they were doing very similar things. I remember very easily talking to friends of mine, and they're like, yeah, I put some money in this real estate company. They're going to build these huge buildings and we're going to start getting a return. And then when I looked at it, they were promising like 25% return per month, or so. It was something ridiculous amount. I can't remember exactly what it was, but some ridiculous amount. I was like, there's no way this is possible, right? If it's too good to be true, you should really look into it further. And for the first couple of years, it was working really good. People were getting money and those type of things. But then all of a sudden, with one day, it disappeared.
There's something that always happens in these scams, and we talked about previous about crypto and Bitcoin, things like that. And the two big ones, Sam Bankman-Fried, both of them, if you look into it, neither of them had substance. I think Rugatova they didn't even have blockchain in there. There was no blockchain in there, and they generated. So if they'd carried on, you calculated that the amount of Bitcoin that they were saying was going to be available was more than the amount of US dollars in circulation. Now, not all the US dollars are in the US. US dollars are everywhere. Yeah. And if you think about that, that's huge. And you start to put it in perspective. But people get greedy. I bought these Bitcoins. I'm going to make all this money on them. And that greed, emotive element, is what the fraudster plays on.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back to the PayVision one, just to give some context here,
yeah,
the total amount stolen. Now, the two people, the main players, were Uwe Lenhoff and a guy called Rudolf Bucher. Now, there was 55 million went through PayVision. The total companies and platforms attributed to another players, a guy called Gal Barak, who was arrested in Bulgaria, was 75 million. So we're talking there 130 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the fraud. The kicker for the bank, ING, when they were prosecuted for money laundering, because this law went through them, they were fined 775 million for 130 million fraud. Now, that's the upfront cost. The cost of remediating for ING Bank would probably be equivalent to the amount of the fine.
Mm-hmm.
It'd probably be on a 5-year watch list with the banks. Now, the thing here, before ING started working with these people, we talked about KYC before, both Lenhoff and Barak from 2016 were financial market supervisors, advised the bank against the fraud schemes being run by these people, but they still went ahead. So the bank ignored the information that was available in the public domain. So banks will search that. They've either not found it or they've ignored it. Just because they've not found it doesn't mean it's not there. So their search capabilities could have been run. And we can talk about process if you want, about how deep banks need to go. But that is a good example where the bank has not been aware. People have been scammed. There's a whole host of companies. I've got about a list of 12 companies here that these two people, through PayVision, used as boiler room scams.
Yeah, it just seems like whatever the newest thing is you want to do, then that's what people are going to take advantage of. Oh, the scammers that are out there are going to take advantage of.
Scammers will stay one step ahead.
Yep. Crypto is the new kind of a scammer, because Bitcoin has been going up. Everybody wants to get involved, and so like, here's this new greatest thing that's happening. You need to get involved right away, right? And so let's talk about red flags, right? One is a sense of urgency to do something before you can do your due diligence on it. The other one is too good to be true.
Yes.
Right. What else could we think of that would be kind of warning signs?
The pressure to do it now. Lost opportunity, that lost opportunity. If you don't do it now, this won't be available tomorrow.
Okay. Right.
That's pressure. They'll put pressure on you as well. So you can say that's two, pressure and lost opportunity.
And then I remember in the case of Sunrise Equity, there's like they did have an offering, a memorandum, right? But there was no, SEC disclaimer. There was no, so that's the other part of it. I think that's really important is that you know, all the areas that I've seen where the scams have happened, there hasn't, you could easily look at, let's suppose, if there was an offering, sometimes there's not even that. You just, you know, I'm your brother, please trust me, that type of thing, which is, you should raise a red flag. But the other part of it is that there's a process you need to go through from the regulator side before you can raise money from the public. And a lot of times, yeah, that doesn't happen either. So maybe that could be another sign, right? Show me your offering memorandum or prospectus or something like that.
And if you get one, read it.
Yeah.
Check it. Because an organized scammer will have these things ready and will have it proofread. But a lot of people, when you ask them for something, they'll say, oh, we need this, and they'll scurry around. I've seen documents signed with dates on that don't even exist. The 29th of February. Really? Or the 30th of February. 30th of February. And, you know, you read through these spelling mistakes.
Yep.
You know? Written in a language that they expect you not to be able to translate to.
Mm.
Oh, it's an official document because it's stamped by a notary. Yeah, but I'd like to read the content. People always say to me, David, do you have to read it all? Yes, I do. I read it all. I read it every page. Yeah, I might not read every single word, but I'll read every page of a document. And I will send it back and say, this is wrong. And the number of frauds that I've picked up by documents, and they're not being signed, dated incorrectly. There's just something on the document. The copy looks wrong. So if you receive a document, be careful about it as well. Because the fraudster will have all of this available. If you ask a question like, can I have some documentation to support your proposal or offering? They may have something available, but it's likely to be flawed. There may be spellings. They may spell your name wrong. Oh, well, that was the previous one that we did. Oh,
yeah.
You know, little indicators.
You could also, I guess you can also do is if they offer you an offering memorandum, you can, like I know in the US, if they offered you a prospectus, you can go to the SEC website, Securities and Exchange Commission, you can just type in their name and see if something comes up. Because most likely if it's a fraud, they wouldn't have taken the time to register with the SEC anyway. So, or in the UK FCA, right?
Yeah. Another one when you talk about it, if you ask for security, so if somebody wants a loan from, so they come to you and say, can you lend me this? Or what assets do you have as security? Well, I have these houses, here's the documentation. Does the house actually exist? That before, you know, the house doesn't exist. Google Maps now apparently is great for a lot of people, but go and visit it. Does it there? Is it of substance? You know? Little things like that some people don't do. Simple ones, because you'll be under pressure to do it, but pick up the phone. I've had people say, oh, he's very good character, he's got great character. I said, well, has anybody phoned the office? We have an office in Pakistan. Phone Pakistan. Oh, yeah, we know that guy. Yeah, he's just been charged with corruption. But it's only in the local papers. So it won't be in your search in the UK or the US. But pick up the phone to people. Your network to call out some of the things that the fraudster is telling you.
Because this is really important for people to know. So one of them is you know, the time sensitivity of the matter, right? The other one is the get rich quick. You're going to make a lot of money really, really fast, right? The third one we mentioned is documentation. What can they provide you? And then even if they provide to you, the fourth one is check on what it is that they're doing. Do your own due diligence because of it. And if it takes work, then you can get a return. If it's like if it was get rich quick, then they could have probably just done it themselves without getting your money out of it.
If it's bona fide, it'll still be there tomorrow. If you miss a cutoff date, then you're not in any worse situation than you were today.
That's a very good point. It's like if you don't get involved, right, in the get rich quick, then you're no better off tomorrow than you were today because you still have your money.
Exactly. Well, you're probably better off. Yeah, you're probably better off. Well, your life won't change, will it? You'll be in the same situation that you were today. And you always have, I always say you have two options with anything. You either do it or you don't.
Yeah.
Those are your options, yes or no. It's binary. If you keep life binary, it becomes a lot simpler.
Now, one thing that I did want to talk about is a little bit about psyche, and that is that I know I'm a very optimistic person, so I'm going to say this, right? So there are certain people that are out there that are literally like they run scams. That's what they do for a living. Aside from that, there are company. I mean, I mentioned to you Sunrise Equity in Canada. There was a UM Financial, or you can take the biggest one of them all, Bernie Madoff, right? So my thing is that they usually start off legitimate, and then something happens where they need to do something which is maybe a little bit illegal or those type of things, and then they go down a rabbit hole that they can't get out of. Would you say that's been your experience as well, or is really all these even the bigger scams like Bernie Madoff were they literally from the beginning out to get everybody?
I think some people, like you suggest, they go down a road and they get too far in and they have to continue. So one of the first frauds that I looked at was Robert Maxwell, of the four Mirabeau newspapers. And he got into a hole from his borrowing, trying to go very big, and going big costs money. And he had all of this money in these groups, and he was using the four groups of companies as if it was almost his personal treasure chest. I've got 750 million, I can do with it as I want. And but as an individual, you have to remain separate from the corporate. You can't go dipping into the pension funds of various companies. I looked at it after the event, so it's easy with hindsight to look at these things. But reading a lot of the papers that were there, bankers particularly got pulled in by Bob Maxwell's personality. Everybody wanted to be part of Bob Maxwell. So as a banker, we've got Bob Maxwell on our books. We've got Bob Maxwell, and people will do it with the current US president. We've got Donald Trump on our book. However, when you look at these things with hindsight, people forgot the control element that a bank would normally do. Now, I'm an optimistic person, but I'm also very risk focused. And people in banking will say, well, David, we have to make a decision, but we need more information to make the right decision.
Sure.
And so when I look at Maxwell from a perspective of hindsight, you can see the lack of control because people were, it's a strong word, but bullied by Bob Maxwell. He was a big personality, but people wanted to be part of his world. They wanted the cachet of having him on the banker's books.
Was that something like, for example, they could see that he was a successful person and they wanted to be successful like him and he was able to play off of that?
Yeah, they ride on his coattails, for want of a metaphor. But the banks wanted to have him on their books because of the cachet of having him
I
on the
see.
books. Well, banks will want to have Donald Trump on their books because he's Donald Trump. He's a wealthy man, allegedly.
Wealthy or not, he's definitely president now, so
Having the president of the United States as your customer, huge, but he carries a lot of risk and control that you have to apply. If we extend that, there was a case, and it was in the public domain, Barclays. They were fined 72 million. It's going back to about 2014, 2015. And they onboarded a PEP, and it was a Middle Eastern prince.
So Pep is a politically exposed person.
Sorry, a politically exposed person. Now, the due diligence you have to do on a politically exposed person is quite high. We talked more about a source of funds, source of wealth. The bank did not do the due diligence correct. They did lots of let's search the internet to death and print everything off. But what they didn't do was go and speak to the customer to confirm the amounts of wealth, because the deal that they were doing involved big numbers. We're talking billions here. And they relied on what was on the internet without substantiating it through documentation from the customer. So you can read on the internet that Mr. Brown Prince is worth X million. But where does that come from? And a good example, when I was at the same bank, we had the Queen Elizabeth II as a customer. one of the banks was working at, which is not unusual for some of the banks. And when you were doing her social work, if you use the Times Sunday Rich list, she was worth 500 million. If you used Forbes, she was worth billions, because Forbes used the state houses that she had, state things. So there's a big disconnect between what she was actually worth, I don't know, and what it was perceived that she was worth in Forbes. So it depends which source you use. So you have to put perspective around it.
I really want to highlight on your point about, you know, just the having the people around you. You want to be part of that circle that is successful. When you mentioned with Bob Maxwell, because a lot of the scams that happen are, you look at the person, they have an online profile, they know driving nice cars, and then doing that, like, well, I, you know, your brain tends to think, oh, well, if he's successful, then I can ride his coattails or her coattails, and I'll be successful as well. So when they ask for money, I'll be able to easily give it to them because of that reason. And you find that more and more. I mean, I remember when I was in Malaysia, there was the One Malaysia Development Berhad, one MDB, which is the largest ones that was there. And that's all it was. I mean, the main guy was bringing Leonardo DiCaprio and all these actors and rappers and all these things. But people don't realize that a lot of times these celebrities show up, they get paid for it.
Yeah.
Right, they don't just show up because they're friends. They get paid for showing up, and so you know, for people who don't know, that is a huge part of it. So I think one of the other ones that I would mention as a red flag would be, you know, what is their online profile? Is it too good to be true as well?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Yes. That's identifying it. Then have you verified it? And one of the key phrases throughout my career: evidence to support. Is what you should go off.
President Reagan said, trust, but verify.
Exactly. I trust you. Yep. Show me.
Absolutely. And I think we've kind of been going in and out of this as we've been discussing, which is basically affinity marketing. And I will tell you, when I was suckered back in the 2000s, that was affinity marketing. He played really on my emotions and my need to do good. To be able to do that, right? That's one of the big things. And I think you will find that in a lot of different areas, whether it be, you know, whether it be businesses that are going after your money to be able to quote unquote make riches, or it could be charitable as well. It could be something where you say, you know, it could be an individual or a group that says basically that, you know, we really need you to make and give us money because we're going to do good, those type of things. And then you get scammed that way as well. So,
definitely. And I think one that has, they really play on now is that fear of missing out, that FOMO, particularly with the younger generations. And I can say that as a gray-haired old man. He said that fear of missing out. Oh, they'll say, everybody's doing this.
Yes.
You don't want to miss out, do you? Well, show me first, and then I'll consider it.
David, thank you very much for your time. It's really been a pleasure talking to you, because I think we've learned a lot, right? What we started off talking about, just the process of opening banks accounts, from anti-money laundering to knowing your customer, kind of moved into the idea of how do people get scammed. And basically it's, you know, time sensitive, it's outsized returns, great too good to be true, falling into your inner circle. You need to be part of my success. You need to, you know, to do that. So all of those things. I think how we just ended up with more like the affinity marketing, playing on your emotions, whether it be religious or some other kind of community emotion, to be able to get or extract money from you. And sometimes, unfortunately, it's family also. Sometimes there is a distant cousin.
Those romance scams that we see at the moment pushing around, those are terrible things.
Yeah.
Where people are taken with their whole life savings, or pension scams and things like that. But they play on the vulnerabilities of people.
Yep, they do. That's very true. Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for asking me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Halal Money Matters. If you like what you hear, please do rate us on the app stores and also leave us a review. It helps other people find us a lot easier.
The thoughts and opinions expressed on Halal Money Matters do not necessarily reflect the views of Saterna Capital, Amana Mutual Funds, or their affiliates. Please consider an investment's objectives, risks, charges, and expenses carefully before investing. To obtain this and other important information about the Amana Funds in a current prospectus or summary prospectus, please visit amanafunds.com or call toll-free 1-800-728-8762. Please read the prospectus or summary prospectus carefully before investing. The Amana Funds are distributed by Saterna Brokerage Services, member FINRA and SIPC, and a wholly owned subsidiary of Saterna Capital, the investment advisor to the Amana Funds. Investing involves risk, including the risk that you could lose money. The Amana Funds restrict investments to those companies consistent with Islamic and sustainable principles, which limits opportunities and may affect performance. This material is for general information only and is not a research report or commentary on any investment products offered by Saterna Capital. This material should not be construed as an offer to sell or the solicitation of an offer to buy any security in any jurisdiction where such an offer or solicitation would be illegal. We do not provide tax, accounting, or legal advice to our clients, and all investors are advised to consult with their tax, accounting, or legal advisors regarding any potential investment. Investors should not assume that investments in the securities and/or sectors described were or will be profitable. This podcast is prepared based on information Saterna Capital deems reliable. However, Saterna Capital does not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the information. Investors should consult with a financial advisor prior to making an investment decision. The views and information discussed in this commentary are at a specific point in time, are subject to change, and may not reflect the views of the firm as a whole. All material presented in this publication, unless specifically indicated otherwise, is under copyright to Saterna. No part of this publication may be altered in any way, copied, or distributed without the prior express written permission of Saterna Capital.
Performance data quoted herein represents past performance and is no guarantee of future results. Investment return and principal value of an investment will fluctuate so that an investor's shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than their original cost. Current performance may be significantly higher or lower than data quoted herein. Performance current to the most recent month end can be obtained by visiting amanafunds.com or by calling toll-free 1-800-728-8762. Please consider an investment's objectives, risks, charges, and expenses carefully before investing. To obtain this and other important information, which you should carefully consider before investing, about the Amana Funds in a free prospectus or summary prospectus, please visit amanafunds.com or call 1-800-728-8762.